History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. When it comes to World War II technology, the country that most people focus on is Germany. Its tanks and its fighters were superior to those of the United States in the beginning of the war, and there was a lot of development on secret weapons programs that still intrigue people to today, and a lot know that they were also fairly well advanced and far along in a nuclear weapons program. Operation Paperclip was a program to bring Nazi scientists to the United States after World War II. Many of them were absolutely critical members of the Apollo program and allowed the United States to win the space race. A country that gets less attention is Japan. Most know, if they're into naval history, that the early fighters and the naval combat fighters were superior to those of the United States, but after a while the U.S. beats them technologically. However, what most people don't know is that Japan developed a nuclear weapons program in World War II that not only was advanced, but it was arguably in front of Germany, and they possibly detonated a nuclear device in 1945 and would have been able to use weapons in the war if they would have begun sooner and not thought that the war would have ended sooner. Today, I'm speaking with Robert Wilcox, who's author of the book Japan's Secret War, How Japan's Race to Build Its Own Atomic Bomb Provided the Groundwork for North Korea's Nuclear Program. He first wrote the book in 1985, and this is its third edition. His work was based on decades of research into national intelligence archives in the United States and Japan, and he looks at a number of things, such as the secret giant industrial complex in North Korea, where Japan's atomic research and testing culminated, how Russia stole a lot of this research, and how they arguably helped North Korea get set up with their own program in the late 1940s and 1950s that didn't really culminate into anything, but the seeds planted for what came decades later. Robert mentions that Japan itself is very interested in this book, as they're thinking on how to rebuild their military and build up their armaments in the face of Chinese aggression into the South China Sea, and possibly become a nuclear nation again. So this is a very interesting account on World War II that most people don't think about. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Robert Wilcox. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Scott. Glad to be here.
Well, I am very fascinated by this topic because I get a lot of listener questions about World War II, and there's this mystique about Germany's technological development and a lot of their overly complicated weapons. Some would call them super weapons. But Japan doesn't get that same type of focus, and that's what we'll be looking at. To start things off, I'm curious about what Japan's overall level of technology is in the 1940s. Some people mentioned that its fighters were better than what the United States had at the beginning of the war. So I know that little tidbit, and I know that Japan pushed an aggressive reform program starting from the mid to third quarter of the 19th century onward, which brings us to the beginning of World War II. But where is Japan if we look at the big picture of aircraft carriers, artillery, manufacturing, and other things? Is it far ahead of the United States, on par, behind? What do you make of it?
Well, I'm not an expert on that specific part of it. However, Japan had been at war for 10 years before we took them on, and they were therefore much more veteran at warfare and at how to do it, at least in Asia, where they were at war. I would say at the beginning of the war, they were better than us. As far as their industrial capacity, that was the whole thing that got Japan out of the Middle Ages. When Perry came and showed up in Japan, he astounded the Japanese. They were sort of in the Middle Ages and didn't realize that elsewhere in the world, things were really, really advancing, especially industrially. And so they began a program of becoming an industrial power. And after World War I, where they were allied with us, and they took over, for instance, as a spoil of war, Korea, they began to build a huge industry, and they had already done that by that time in Japan itself, and then began to move into Asia so that they could exploit the resources there. So at the beginning of the war, no question, they were a power to be reckoned with. Their navy alone was terrific. You know, they had built carriers, they had built battleships. When the war started, they had us outnumbered in that regard. And their army was very well trained. It had been victorious in many battles in Asia. And as far as science goes, they realized they had to get with Western science, and they did so. They had very top-rated scientists. In my story about Japan making an atomic bomb, are trying to, there is evidence they did. They were all over the world. One of the key scientists in my story was a protege of Einstein, worked with him, a friend of his, Niels Bohr, the same. So they were building a giant industry, and key in my story is Korea, where they had unknown basically to the West, although it became known as the war went on, they had built a giant industrial complex all along the shoreline of Korea and into those mountains, which we eventually encountered at the Chosin Reservoir. All those things were built by Japan. So in a nutshell, they were quite formidable as an industrial and a growing power, and especially as a war-fighting power at that time.
Right. From the late 1800s onward, the non-Western world looked to Japan as a model of reform, of taking the fruits of Westernism in their mind, of science, of technological advancement, of military success, without having to take on other aspects of Westernism that they didn't want to, like religion or different types of philosophy, which Japan didn't. And I wonder, before we get into the particulars of Japan's atomic weapons program, there's been a lot of research and analysis of Germany's nuclear weapons program, but Japan hasn't been a part of that. Do you think it's because Japan wasn't considered this technological powerhouse like Germany was, or it's just simply not known as well? Why do you think this part of Japan's history isn't discussed?
Well, the simple answer is that they're in the mysterious East. We looked at the West and figured the West was better, and this was stupid. They were doing their own and were very comparable. By the way, the Germans and the Japanese worked together in this Japanese atomic bomb program. They weren't arm in arm. There was a lot of subterfuge and so on, but they both knew and both were working on an atomic bomb, and they helped each other, sometimes almost with pulling your arm to do it, but they did do that. One of the big stories in my book is how the last submarine leaving from Germany, from Kiel, Germany, literally as Germany is capitulating and dying at the end of the war, it has on it uranium bound for Japan. One of the problems for Japan was finding it and processing it and so on, and is still a mystery about what happened there. But they worked together much more than we know. And another simple answer is just simple prejudice. We just didn't think the Japanese could do this. They were just not regarded as up to the task as we are. And you have to remember that there are different ways to make atomic weapons, and not everybody doesn't have to follow our way. And that's what we ran into at the end of the war when we found out what they had done.
Right. I mean, America's approach to the Manhattan Project was a tremendous industrial approach with multiple laboratories. But let's stick with Japan. And I'm curious, could you walk me through what is Japan's research program like? Can you describe its origin from when research scientists know that this is theoretically possible and begin setting up their own programs in Germany and the United States and Japan and elsewhere? So what are its origins in Japan, and how did it develop?
Well, Japan was right on at the same time all the rest of the world powers were when it was discovered in Germany that nuclear fission could make a bomb. They knew it. And early on, even before they attacked us, they began looking for uranium. And that was their idea. They realized that an atomic bomb could be made and it would be a big weapon. But when they went into war with us, they didn't think the war would last long enough to make one. So it was kind of a low priority at that time. You know, the famous model called the Saturnian model of the atom with those planets rotating around it, or those minor, you know, tiny, minuscule thing. That was first proposed by a Japanese physicist. Nagoaki, I think his name was. So they knew about all of this, and they knew what was coming. But when the war started, they didn't ever think they'd have to make a bomb to win the war. Their main idea was to give us the big punch in the nose, hurt us badly, which they did at Pearl Harbor, although that was really the turning point in the war, because it made us come back as hard as we could, no matter what. But they figured the war would be over early, so it was a low priority. Even before Pearl Harbor, the Japanese general who was in charge of this kind of thing, he called his people in and he said, let's see if we can make a bomb. And they did begin to look at it in a pilot program, but not much really thinking they were ever going to use it at that time.
What was their approach? Was it similar to the United States, where you have a massive investment of resources and multiple laboratories working in coordination? Is it more like Germany, where there are different labs, they're not necessarily on the same page? Is it something different than those two?
No, the main difference was that Japan is a little country, and they didn't have a lot of fissionable material in Japan proper, although we still don't really know the truth about that. But anyway, they didn't. And so let me tell you that Japan had a program just like the Manhattan Project when they decided to go full guns with it. But it wasn't within their borders, and that was the big difference. They had to go over to Asia in their occupied areas, and even before the war, they had started to look for uranium. And uranium was big for a while, as far as they were looking. But, if, you know, there are other elements like thorium and those kinds of things which can be used to make a bomb with. But at the beginning of the war, they had search parties out, and they had huge diggings, thousands of coolies and Japanese monitoring them and so on, to dig all this stuff out. But they had to bring it back in the waters, back to Japan, where supposedly, or at least in the beginning, that's where the project was headquartered. So they had they actually had a program in China. They had a program in Manchuria, and a program in Japan. Everything being run from Japan, but it was parsoned out. Like, we would send we would go to Oak Ridge for certain things, and we would go to Washington State. They'd have to go to Shanghai. They'd have to go elsewhere. So they had that problem. As the war continued and it became more of a priority object, this hurt them in that their ships were sunk, that were bringing back ores and so on. And at the very end of the war, well, let's say early 1945, when America began to bomb Japan, everything, all of the pilot programs for Japan, and you know, this was really an engineering problem. The physics was known. Yashua Nishina was one of the pilot program scientists. He's a world renowned. He was a top physicist. He knew how to make a bomb. It was getting the materials and then engineering it. And once Japan was under our bombing attack daily, they moved the pilots. They had already engineered separators. You needed separators to separate raw uranium into the fissionable element, the U-235. And they moved it over they were doing other things as well. You know, you can use thorium. It's not as we tried to use thorium in the 50s, but it didn't. We just decided to stick with uranium because the thorium is more doubtful, and you could have an explosion while you're working with it and so on. They moved it over to Korea. And this was one of the big things that I found out that nobody had even, you know, at the end of the war, we finally, when we intercepted that submarine, and that's what happened to that submarine that was bringing uranium to Japan, they already had it. But this was, separated uranium. It was fissionable uranium. And I think when they intercepted that, we did, America did, we finally realized that, hey, we never thought the Japanese were doing anything, but wait a minute, what is this submarine, this German submarine bound for Tokyo with all this uranium on it? We better check it out. And so we hastily organized what was called the atomic bomb mission and went in to Japan. We still didn't uncover much of anything. The Japanese lied through their teeth, and understandably, they had just suffered the bombing, you know, the first atomic bombing, and seen what it done, and they didn't want their people to know that they had done it too. And I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but right after that, why we have beaten Japan, and we need Japan as a ally against Russia. So we said, sure, we're not going to tell anybody what you did. That's fine. It'll all be top secret. You keep your secret. You help us. We just need you as a jumping off point. But so their project ultimately was just as successful in terms of sending things out to other smaller pilot programs, developing separators in order to separate the uranium and also other machinery, and they moved it over to Korea. And Korea was literally unknown to us. We weren't even bombing Korea during the war. Oh, there were some minor little things. And they had this huge industrial power over there with more electrical power than you could ever imagine. It was through those Chosin Reservoir power plants. And that's where, as the war got worse for Japan, the atomic bomb project that they had became higher and higher in priority until it was finally, in the beginning, they had hoped they could maybe use a bomb against us and bring it over by a bomber. Well, that was out of the question. But they knew they were going to be invaded. That's when it became top priority. They were going to use it on the fleet when it came in, and they were going to put it on submarines or surface ships and move it out there. That's a pretty long-winded explanation, but they had the same kind of program we did. It was just in a different way. It was out in Asia. Pieces of it were working, and in the end, we know that they had a project in Manchuria that may have been just as big. But you know, the Russians came in at the end of the war, if you recall this, and took over Japan, I believe, Korea. I believe they were much closer to this. They knew that the Japanese main plants were in Korea, where, in my book, you will see, it has been reported many times, some top secret, that they actually exploded a bomb. Too late, the Russians came in, and they never could use it, but that's where they ended up, and that was where we didn't have a clue about what was going on until after the war.
Hey everyone, a short break on this discussion of Japan's nuclear program to discuss how you can take your mind off your current situation if you happen to be in quarantine, which most of us are. A lot of us are going a bit stir crazy, and it helps to be transported somewhere else. And a great resource that gives you almost infinite content and allows you to mentally go almost anywhere in time and space is Audible.com. Audible is a provider of spoken word entertainment and audiobooks, and you get access to 200,000 books. Everything from bestsellers to memoirs to history books to self-development to podcasts. And you can check out classic history reads like Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel. Every month, a member gets one credit to pick any title, plus two Audible originals from a monthly selection, and access to daily podcasts from the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post. You can download a book and listen offline anytime, anywhere. You listen via an app that can be installed on smartphones and tablets, and you can listen across devices without losing your spot. You can keep your credits up to a year and use them to binge a whole series if you want to. So these days, if all you can really do when you go outside is go on a walk or go to the grocery store, Audible lets you make the most of that time by listening while you're commuting, traveling, and make it possible for you to read a book when you don't have time to otherwise. If you'd like a free audiobook, visit audible.com/historyunplugged or text historyunplugged, all one word, to 500-500. Again, get a free audiobook by visiting audible.com/historyunplugged or text historyunplugged to 500-500. I want to come back to this issue of what Japan was planning to do with its nuclear weapons, because for whatever reason, these dark scenarios and alternate histories seem to intrigue people. But do you think that Japan would have been successful?
I hope you don't think this is a dark scenario like a conspiracy theory.
Oh, no.
This thing is very documented. It's all extremely documented. I mean, I got 550 footnotes in here that document everything that's written in here. This really happened. This is not just an idea that maybe it happened.
Oh, yeah, I get that. I'm more curious of if it had armed a fleet of bombers. We'll get back to that in a second. But one question I have is, from what I understand of Germany's program, and I'll probably get out of my depth here very quickly, is that from refining uranium into weapons-grade uranium, I think Germany had a problem where they assumed it would take an enormous amount to have a successful bomb, whereas the United States did refine uranium, but also refine plutonium, and that was a factor that helped it be successful. And I'm probably getting something wrong here, but from what you can tell of Japan, were they on the right track, and had their industrial military complex not been destroyed, do you think they would have succeeded where Germany did not succeed?
Yes, I absolutely do. I believe that they actually made a bomb, and it was this isn't just me. I mean, there are reports from our intelligence and so on that they made a bomb and exploded it. It was a test bomb off of the coast of Korea. And if the war hadn't ended right then, which it did, this was on August 10th that they did this, and there's much confirmation of this. You have to go into deep secret stuff that nobody knew about, or that wasn't available at the end of the war. It took someone to dig it out. There were little blurbs about it, but anyway, they made a bomb. There are also, and I'm not an expert on Germany, let me tell you. I've spent decades on Japan, and I don't even speak the language. It's very, very tough. But there's a lot more to be learned about what Germany did. I have seen myself top secret reports, which are very valid reports, that they that the Germans themselves developed some sorts of smaller nuclear bombs up in the north, and there are they used concentration camp victims and so on, and fired off a couple of these. They were much more developed than we generally know. If you go and dig into it, you will find this out. But Germany is not my area. I actually worked with my assistant. I've kept telling him to write a book about Germany because he knows a lot about this. That's his particular interest. And there's a lot more to be learned about Germany. But and there's more to be learned about what Japan did. But my book absolutely puts to rest the idea that they didn't go very far, that they didn't know very much. They got right to the edge there. There's very good evidence they fired off a test bomb in the sea next to Korea, but the Russians came in, they took over North Korea, they kept everyone out, even to the point of shooting down American planes. And for 3 years, they looted all of the plants that the Japanese had. And as you know, the Russians are the next to have the atomic bomb. And while they had spies in our plants, they also had the Russian plants. And there's no question in my mind, and the book, I think, clearly doesn't just say that, it proves it. They took a lot from the Japanese plants. And eventually, when they were done in 1948, the Russians gave the plants back to North Korea, and that is the beginning of the North Korean nuclear program, which threatens us and the world today. And there's no question about that. The three big scientists who are heralded in North Korea all start at Konan, Korea, Hungnam, Korea today, which is where the Japanese plants were. So there's a real continuum here, and the only thing left to do is to actually I don't know, go find the broken parts of the bomb there on that shore. But I wrote two other editions of this earlier when I got onto this. I mean, this has been a long, long time study, and the Japanese would not publish them. They just published, with the publication of this one, Japan's Secret War, the third edition. They published this one because a Japanese general called me and he said, "We didn't believe what you had written the first two times, but you've proved it to us now. And, you know, Japan is trying to get to take its reins back and get away from America being their protector and protect themselves and go nuclear again. And the book is doing quite well in Japan because it's opening the eyes. It had been, you know, that was one of the biggest secrets of the war, that Japan had this bomb, tried to make it, because they have always been looked at as solely the victim of the bomb, and it's in both their interest to keep that secret, because they've gained so much from that. They were purely the victims and nothing else. But the fact is, they tried hard and would have used it in a second had they been able, had the Russians not come in, well, had the war not ended. We beat them to the punch. That's basically what happened.
You know how big the test bomb was? How many kilotons or megatons?
I don't. This first came right after the war. An agent for America, what was it called, the CIC or something, which was digging into Japan in Asia. David Snell, who became a very respected Newsweek and so on correspondent after the war, he wrote a big story in which he met with a Japanese officer who said they had come this far, that they had actually test fired a bomb. And it had been made up in the Chosin Reservoir area, and then it had been brought down to which is about 20, 30 miles, maybe 50 miles. Those are very, very jagged, remote mountains. They brought it down to the coast where it actually had been engineered and so on. And it was put on to they called it a launch. It was probably a 50-foot type thing. And it was puttered out into the middle, maybe 30 miles away from the shore. And then it fired off. I don't know how big it was, but it wasn't as big as ours. But it definitely could have devastated a fleet that would have, would have come in and attacked Japan. So I don't know what the size was. What we have is his reports, and then we have as the war ended, right after it ended, America sent what was called the atomic bomb mission in. It was just like the Alsos mission into Germany. And they interviewed all the scientists who lied through their teeth and said, "Oh, no, we didn't do much. We didn't do anything." And It was eventually realized that they had lied when at first we thought, okay, we can not worry about it. And you remember the incident where all of a sudden America took all of the cyclotrons in Japan, which they had some very big ones. When the war started, they had the largest cyclotron in the world there, and threw them all in Tokyo Bay. You may not remember that, but that was a big, big story. We suddenly realized, wait a minute, they did a lot more than we. And then we started looking at Korea, where their plants were. And by the Korean War, there were actual, and I have all the orders and so on, actual missions by bombers to bomb and destroy what had become the Russian nuclear plants built on what they had taken from Japan. And this is all documented. It's all there. So we didn't know about it. We found out about it. And then there are other smaller stories, many of them indicating that had all happened. And this general who finally got in touch with me and was instrumental in having the book published, he has located some workers around Konan, Korea, who remember this. I don't have those, and my book's already published. I can't get that in there. But it's just part of the continuing story. So I cannot tell you how big the bomb was. All I can tell you is there are numerous reports that it happened.
And believe it or not, my audience is interested in historiography and sources and how history gets made. How are you able to learn about this? Were there archives that had been closed off for a few decades after the war that opened and you were able to see this? Or
you're a historian and you will very much understand this. I read about the fact in the New York Times. I'm just a writer. I look for good stories. I had written my first book. I've written 12 now. I had written my first book. I was looking for another book, and I read on the front page of the New York Times that there was the possibility that Japan had tried to make an atomic bomb. I don't remember even right now what it was, but I really, that said to me, wow, that's a big book. That nobody knows this. And, oh, yeah, it had to do with a Spanish agent who had worked for the Japanese. His name was Velasco. And anyway, he had said this and some other thing. There was some other stuff. So I just picked up the phone. I don't remember how I got a hold of this, but I got a hold of one of the big Yale professors of history. I called him up, and I'll give you his name in a second. It's terrible that I can't remember it right now, but I called him up and I said, is there anything to do with this? Actually, I went to see him, Derek DeSola Price, Yale Avalon professor of the history of science. And I went to visit him and he said, you know, something big happened and it's all been covered up. And he said, we have tried, meaning he and some of his assistants have tried, and we're just running into a stone wall. But if you go to Japan, you might find out more about it. Well, I did that. I was in good situation at that time, and I got an advance from Dial Press, and I went to Japan, and I literally talked to everybody. It turned out that Yasuo Nishino is sort of the father of physics in Japan. It doesn't turn out. That's the way it was. And Nishino had been the head of the army program. And he had early on been brought in and basically to do a pilot program. And, you know, the army and the navy were very much at odds with each other in Japan. It has to do with their culture and everything else. And they didn't even talk to each other. But simultaneously, another noted physicist named Bunsako Arakatsu, he was brought in by the Navy. And so they have these two programs going on, one by Nishina and one by Arakatsu. The Nishina program is the one that most people have heard about, or at least if you dig into this, you find out it. And Nishina was He was very, very well regarded, and he was a great friend of Niels Bohr, and they used to talk to each other until the war started. And anyway, I went to Japan. I interviewed people who were involved in this. The guy who built all of the huge industry in Korea, he was dead. But Jun Noguchi was his name. But he was one of the zaibatsu, like Mitsubishi and all the rest of them. But he was a self-made guy, and he did it by going over to Korea and starting a huge industrial complex there. And he had heavy water plants there before the war started. Eventually, and I will never forget sitting in Nishina's, it's sort of a shrine now. The Rikan is a huge area. I mean, acres and acres and acres, 1,000 acres, and it has all kinds of stuff on it. But this is where it all began. And I went to his office, and his secretary, and she set up some meetings with some of Nishina's physicist assistants who worked on the bomb with him. And I remember a guy, his name was Tamaki, and he's a big physicist. I don't think he's alive now. This was like 30, 40 years ago. And I remember Tamaki saying to me, well, when we were working on the physics of it, which we easily did, it was well known, and we figured this out. The problem was going to be we would need a great industrial power. And he said, they said to us, don't worry, Noguchi will take care of that. And subsequently, after interviewing, I would say 25 people involved with the program, I was able to write my first edition of this, which was published by Morrow. And there was much to be learned at that time. And 10 years later, it was republished by Marlowe in 1995, and I went back. And you asked me about did I find any secret documents? Well, boy, oh boy! I went to the National Archives this was in 1985, and I was able to find an area of the archives that was marked off. And what it was boxes of things, of documents that had never been, that have not yet been read or classified. And so I had a friend there who had helped me with something earlier that I had, and he was quite a legendary archivist there, and he was able to get me in to begin to look through these boxes. And the boxes were like, these are from the occupation in Tokyo. These are from, and they were sufficiently labeled so that I didn't have to go through all 300 boxes, but I could start picking out things. And that's when I'll never forget it. I started looking, maybe for 3 or 4 days, not much luck. And then I pulled out this report by that David Snell, that CIC agent who talked about that they had fired off this bomb. And that was the beginning. And from there, I was able to get into top secret CIA documents from the war, from the Korean War, and between World War II and the Korean War. And I mean, it was just a hunting expedition. It was a find a needle in a haystack. You would go, but slowly you began to get names, you began to get times, you began to get units, and you could go places, and lo and behold, it began to click together. And that's how the story came out, and both going to Japan and the National Archives.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. One other factor with this You mentioned a little bit about spies from the Soviet Union infiltrating the Manhattan Project. I think his name was George Koval from the United States, who spied on the Manhattan Project for the Soviet Union. Another spy in Japan, Richard Sorge, who was German, but spied also for the Soviets and didn't speak great Japanese, but he was at the German embassy and had a lot of friends there and would find intelligence and send it back to Russia. As far as you know, were there any spies who infiltrated the Japanese atomic program? I could see how that would be a little bit more complicated. Or maybe they did. I don't know.
Great question. You see, that first article that I saw, that one in the New York Times, the thing that got me onto this in the first place, it was about a guy named Alcathar de Velasco. And by the way, I know of those spies you just spoke for. They were very important spies. His name was Alcathar de Velasco, and he was a Falange, working for Franco during the Civil War, and a very, very tough fascist type guy and a spy, and very flamboyant, ex-bullfighter and that kind of thing. And the story, one of the stories that I dug up early was that he said he worked for the Japanese and actually spied on our Los Alamos. And he did so by coming through Mexico on a submarine. And when you check all this out, that was going on big time. There were lots of Japanese spies down in Mexico when the war started and throughout the war. And he was in the book, you will read that I went to Spain and I interviewed him, and he told me, "Oh yes, I went to I went to Mexico. The Japanese hired me. They did so through their German contacts, because he was working for he loved the Germans and was working for the Germans, and they sent him to Mexico. He went there, and he was to." And I can't remember right now, but he sends two Mexicans into the area where Los Alamos is, and they come back, and he has the Japanese meet him in Mexico. This is like 42, 43, and he remembers how they were sort of afraid to get near the guys. They were supposed to bring back materials. And this all goes along with the fact that there's no question that the Japanese knew we were working on an atomic bomb. Tojo calls his one of the big generals involved in the program, Kawashima, in 43 and says, things are going bad for us. We're going to have to develop the bomb. The Americans are working on it. We have to develop one first because we're losing the war. And you have to realize that the Russians, who had spies all over the world, Korea was right next to them. They border Korea up at the top. There's a little small border of Russia. They knew exactly what was going on in Korea, and their spies. I mean, they had great spies, as you mentioned, Sorge and the other guy. I wasn't too familiar with him, but they had spies through the communist network in our program. Several of them, big ones. The two who were executed. I forget their names now, but spying was really well done by the Russians, and they knew about what was going on, and that is the main reason they came in at the end of the war. They stayed out of the war. They were smart. They stayed out of the war. But at the very end of the war, they realized, hey, there's an atomic plant down in Korea. We're going to take that. So they came in and they sealed it off, and they stole everything they could and then gave the rest to the North Koreans.
And I'd like to hear your take on the afterlife of Japan's nuclear program. I think you mentioned earlier that the United States got access to some cyclotrons, and then Russia found this facility in North Korea, stripped it down to its bones. How did that affect the United States and Russia? And then also you mentioned that North Korea develops a program. And so how are they able to do this? With what sounds like a stripped bare facility?
Yeah, well, it wasn't stripped bare, apparently, but whatever was left was taken over by North Korea, and that was the beginning of their nuclear program. They were a fledgling nothing nation in 1948. They had nothing, but they did have that area where Japan had tried to make an atomic bomb. You know, the last battles of World War II were fought in November 1945 by the Japanese against the Russians. They were still fighting. The Japanese hated the Russians, and they didn't want them to get this stuff. And when the Russians came in, it appears, and there are top secret documents for a long time where we were watching the Russians. They would send a submarine to Konan, Korea, and it would take something away. And what I think that was there was a refinery, something that was making fissionable material, and they were taking it to Russia. Russia did not destroy that area. It just looted it. It just took what it wanted, what it needed. Once it had its bomb, which, you know, there's a good historical evidence to suggest that they got the bomb before they announced it in 1952, that they had it before that. But anyway, they used part of that, and they didn't destroy it at all. I have pictures from when our forces during the Korean War went to the Chosin Reservoir, the famous defeat that we had. They landed right there in Konan, Korea, where the Japanese plants had been, and I have pictures of it. It's a huge, huge place. And someone like who was the famous New York Times I forget his name now, but he's a very famous New York Times writer. He writes an article. He says, I'm walking by the Japanese plants where the Japanese were said to have developed a thorium bomb. Now, I particularly think it was thorium, some type of combination bomb. From everything that I've seen, I don't think they eventually were able to get enough separated uranium 235. It just wasn't. But you could do so. You could manufacture it the word's coming out of my head. I can't remember it right now. But you could do so with other fissionable materials. And so I think it was a kind of a combination bomb that they trucked out to that island and blew it up, and then the war ended. Have I answered your question?
Yes. Yeah. And then getting to North Korea.
Oh, yes. The North Korea. May I continue with that?
Yes.
I'm sorry, but I just want to make it very clear that all of our administrations looking at North Korea have begun the North Korean program about 1955. The reason was that it was sealed off by the Russians, and we just didn't pick it up in time. Now, there's a political aspect to this. A lot of the Carter administration and several others, the Clinton, they were so quick to want to make a deal with North Korea. They never did the hard digging into this to realize that the program really began when the Russians gave it back to the North Koreans. And this is a current security threat, because if we ever had to get into a war with North Korea, we need to know every little underground place they have. And we have neglected everything that happened before 1955. And this isn't me talking. In my book, I got a call from some U.S. Highly secretive investigators working for DOD. This was in 1990, I don't know, 98. No, excuse me, much later than that. And is the reason I did this third edition. And they said to me they had used my book to try to find out things about the Japanese program so that they could pinpoint where to hit North Korea. if they had to do it. They're not planning to do it or anything, but we always are contingency planning. And they said, you don't know us, but everybody's got your book, and they're all trying to do this. And they needed to know there's a gap between the knowledge of what North Korea really has done, how many silos they've built and so on, because there's that gap. America doesn't begin their program until 55. It actually began in 48, and there's lots of stuff that we don't have. It was in your book, and it's giving us. And so I began to know these guys, and they helped me dig out a lot of new top secret information that's all in the new book, and which is the new edition, helps the new edition an awful lot. And North Korea, we don't really know what happened between 48 and 55. We begin the program in 55, and it was our negligence. We just didn't know, and it was partly because the Russians wouldn't let us in there, and then we were just too eager to make a deal. That's one of the secrets of this whole thing.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of modern-day implications here. You mentioned earlier that Japan is interested in this because it wants to return to its legacy and have a more forceful response to Chinese expansion. The seeds for North Korea's nuclear program were planted this time. Are there any other modern-day implications that you can see that come from this story?
Well, the biggest modern-day implication is that we have to understand that the Japanese did it, that they got very far, much farther than we have admitted publicly, and that we need to read and learn from them how they did it. There are many ways to make a nuclear bomb, and we have the kind of conceited idea that the only way to do it is the way we did it or the Russians did it. There are 100 ways to do it. Obviously, there are certain things you have to have, but if you look at the Japanese program, it's a classic program of how someone under the gun, not like us, so different than us, using the same scientific principles could do it, and it wouldn't look like ours. It would look different. It was so hidden that we never figured it out until after the war, and then we've kept it hidden. And we're going to be dealing with all of with Iran, North Korea. Those are going to be the new Axis alliances if we ever have to come to war. And it's going to be done a different way, and we're going to need this information. And that's why those DOD guys came to me, and that's why they use my book, because they're looking at it that way, and they're saying, hey, there's a lot of stuff we didn't realize could have happened. We went, whole hog. We went crazy. We spent everything we could. The Japanese only problem was that they thought they'd win the war early, and they waited too long.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, and you alluded to a lot, but for listeners who want to check out more, they can pick up your book, which is Japan's Secret War, How Japan's Race to Build Its Own Atomic Bomb Provided the Groundwork for North Korea's Nuclear Program.
Third edition, very important, much bigger than the other two.
Third edition, yes. Right. All right, well, thanks a lot for sharing all this, Robert. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, thanks a lot, Scott. I appreciate it.
All right, so that is all for the episode today. As always, I like to kick things off by thanking the Spy Masters for History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spy Masters include Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, The McCrays, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Carl from Norway, Michael from New York, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tyler from Colorado, and Bill Ivy. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.